When is it right to fight? Frontline Fellowship's been a mission to the war zones for almost 40 years now. The law of God is clear. If the thief is found breaking in and he is struck so that he dies, there shall be no guilt for his bloodshed. Exodus 22 verse 2 makes it clear that self-defense is mandated by God's law. Now notice, this is not saying if a murderer, pedophile, rapist, terrorist breaks in. It's just if a thief breaks in at night. But it's dark. You can't see if he's got a weapon. You don't know his intentions, and people shouldn't be breaking into your house anyway. So even if you killed a thief in the night, breaking into your home, there is no guilt for the bloodshed. Self-defense is written into God's law. The law of God establishes the basic right of self-defense. Any person is justified in defending himself or his family whenever they're attacked or whenever their lives are in danger. Any weapon is permissible for use in self-defense. The law of God does not say that the homeowner is guilty if he uses a sword, but innocent if he uses a club. The issue is not one of weapons or tools, it's the basic right of self-defense. Not just a right, but a duty. So for example, when you read of the first murder in the Bible, you don't hear what weapon was used. Cain killed Abel. We don't know if he used a rock, we don't know if he used a knife, we don't know if he used a club. The murder weapon is apparently irrelevant. The point is, the guilt of the murderer is the issue. It's not the tool that you blame. A bad workman blames his tools. It's the individual. Tools don't kill people. People kill people. They use tools in many cases. It's noticeable that God has provided his creatures with weapons. Have you noticed? Almost every animal has some means of defense for flight or fight, or means of camouflage to defend themselves and their loved ones. God has equipped many of his creatures with claws. If you've got any cats, you will discover that. And teeth. If you've got cats, you'll also discover they have teeth, especially if you try to put a pill down their throat. Or talons. Serious talons. I mean, talons of an eagle can be longer than a lion's claws. Or quills. Horns, in the case of rhinos and buffaloes. You don't want to have an argument with a buffalo. Even the impala and the springbok and the kudu, they have horns. Mountain goats, some serious horns. And of course, hooves. And a zebra or any buck or giraffe can kill a lion with a swift kick of the hooves. They've got to be very careful when pursuing them. And tusks. Elephants have tusks. Elephants have right of way. Elephants are formidable, but you don't want to come up against those tusks. They can put those tusks through the side of your car. How can it be that our Creator has provided his creation with weapons and with the instinct to protect the lives of the young? But Bible-believing, born-again, spirit-filled, names written in the Lamb's Book of Life, believers are expected instead to be pacifist doormats. I mean, I've heard Christians who are absolutely convinced that God expects us to... I've heard people saying if someone is attacking his wife, he'd pray. Like, you know, divorce him immediately. This man is worthless. I mean, any man who's not willing to fight, kill, die to defend his wife is not worthy of being called a man or husband. It's not just that they're worse than an unbeliever, they're worse than animal. What animal won't fight to defend their own? Like salt that's lost its saltiness, good for nothing but to be thrown outside and trampled underfoot. There are times when we must stand up, step out, speak up, fight the good fight of faith. The scripture teaches that we need to be ready to defend our family, our faith, and our freedoms, and our future. 1 Timothy 5 verse 8, but if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. It's a very serious scripture. Anyone who fails to provide protection for their family has denied the faith and they're worse than an unbeliever. I'd go further. In fact, those who refuse to protect the young are worse than an animal. What animal will not fight to protect their offspring? Our Lord Jesus himself told his disciples, he who does not have a sword, let him sell his cloak and buy one. Sword is important. And by the way, the sword was the best weapon of that day. It's just like the military assault rifle of today. It was the best weapon. That's why K captains, centurions, they had swords. Pacifism is in defiance of historic Christian teaching. The 39 Articles, which is the foundational statement of the Church of England, states clearly in Article 37, it is lawful for Christian men to carry weapons. Very straightforward. The Westminster Catechism, considered the finest expression of Bible teaching, came out of the Westminster Assembly, out of which came the Westminster Confession and the Westminster Catechism, larger and shorter. In the Westminster Larger Catechism, under the Sixth Commandment, it states that the prohibition against murder requires as our duty all careful studies and lawful endeavors to preserve the life of ourselves and others by resisting by just defense against violence, protecting and defending the innocent. So every command of God has got duties required and sins to be avoided. So under the duties required, every command has a positive command that you must apply. And so you shall not murder means you must resist murder. You must do everything you can to protect yourselves and others from murder. And all careful studies and lawful endeavors to preserve your life and life of others. So that means going to the shooting range, taking self-defense courses, all of these are part of obeying the Sixth Commandment. That when the day comes, we are not helpless victims, but we are able to be a good Samaritan who can protect someone before they get beaten up by someone and left lying bleeding on the road for someone else to find and try and patch up if possible. Proverbs 25 verse 26 says, like a muddied spring or polluted well is a righteous man who gives way to the wicked. To give way to the wicked is terrible. I mean, imagine you are in the wilderness, maybe in the edge of the 1040 window, edge of the Sahara Desert like I've been, and you're trekking all day and you come to a well or a spring and it's polluted. I mean, can you imagine how disgusting that must be? You've walked all day, you haven't had a drink since morning, and at last you find a source of water and it's polluted water. That's how disgusting it is to find a righteous person who gives way to the wicked, who becomes a doormat, who becomes a salt that's lost its savour. When St. James Church of England in Kenilworth, Cape Town, was attacked by UPLO terrorists of the Pan-African Congress on 25th of July 1993, one of our missionaries, Charles van Wyk, was in the congregation. He returned fire. He injured the terrorist who was spraying the congregation with his assault rifle from the doorway. From this distance, basically from where this picture's taken, that's about the distance. Charles was actually further back than that, and the terrorist was standing about there just to the side of the stage in front of that double door, machine gunning the congregation from there. And so that's gun control, being able to hit your target from a good 50 feet away. This resistance by a single member of the congregation with a snub-nosed 38 revolver caused the terrorist to break off the attack and flee. Nehemiah 4 verse 14 declares, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, for your sons and your daughters, for your wives and for your houses. The Bible commands us on many occasions to fight. So just as personal defense, family defense, church defense is necessary, so too there are times when national defense is required. Deuteronomy 28 verse 1 and 7. Now it shall come to pass if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God to observe carefully all his commandments, which I command you today, that the Lord your God, and gives blessing of obedience, which includes in verse 7, he will cause your enemies who rise up against you to be defeated before your face. They shall come out against you one way and will flee before you seven ways. So victory in battle is promised as one of the blessings that come from obedience, generally speaking. The great Christian theologian Augustine of Hippo, St. Augustine lived in the 4th century into the 5th century in North Africa in what today would be Tunisia. The great Christian theologian Augustine of Hippo taught that a Christian could be a soldier and serve both God and his country honorably. Now he propagated the just war theory. He wrote Confessions and City of God. Now in City of God he speaks about the just war. So Augustine spelled out that Christian criteria for the just war, which has been accepted for the last almost 15, 16 centuries. Jus ad bellum, jus in bello, jus post bellum. A just cause for war, a just conduct during the war, and a just conclusion of the war. These are the essentials for a just war. So a just war requires a just cause. Innocent life must be an imminent danger, and intervention must be to protect life. Nothing else justifies lethal force and violence and warfare. Only a duly constituted authority may wage a war. War must be a last resort, or only after having exhausted all peaceful means. There must also be a reasonable possibility of success to justify involvement in a war. It's no point having a sort of charge of the light brigade sort of very gallant, very brave, but ultimately pointless. What good did that ultimately do, throwing away the finest cavalry in Europe before the Russian cannons in a worthless war for absolutely no good reason on the side of Turkey? The Ottoman Turks were murdering Christians against Russia, who was trying to punish Turkey for having murdered Christians. And so Britain and France found themselves on the side of the persecutors of the church, the Ottoman Turks, against the Christians who were trying to protect Christians from persecution in the Middle East. And the Charge of the Light Brigade just epitomizes that kind of pointless gallantry, which was in a worthless war. And there was no success anyway. Just conduct in a war requires that it be limited to military targets and not endanger civilians, not damage environments, nor harm animals. The scriptures clear that soldiers are not even to chop down fruit trees during a war. Deuteronomy 20, verse 19 to 20. When you go to war and you besiege a city, do not cut down the fruit trees. Why not? Because what are you fighting for? A better future. If you're chopping down fruit trees, you're destroying the future. You've got to think for the future. And so the mentality of scorch earth, lay waste to everything, how is that going to build a better future? Like economic warfare that we're seeing right now. Impoverishing hundreds of millions of people, destroying industries, is that going to make a better future? The benefits of the war must be proportional to the costs and the risks of a war. There have been wars that have achieved virtually nothing. I mean, just take the war against COVID. What has the last 2 years of war against COVID done? It hasn't flattened the curve, but it has flattened the economy. It has flattened a lot of people's businesses, and it has flattened many currencies, and it's certainly flattened a whole lot of people's lives and cultures and churches and outreaches and ministries and missions, and you can name it. So is it worth it? There's many a war where the costs so greatly exceed any of the possible benefits and risks. In a just war, there must be a clear distinction between combatants and non-combatants. This is a monument at the Bloemfontein Anglo-Boer War Museum, and it is called Afskeid, the separation, as the man goes off to war with his Mauser and his wife is left behind. You normally would think the man is taking the risks, he's going to war, he's fighting the enemy. But in the Anglo-Boer War of 1899 to 1902, the British Empire, working at the behest of the Rothschild bankers, waged war against the farmers. And it was left to British woman Emily Hobhouse to expose to the world this method of barbarism, where here Australian troops pictured themselves destroying a person's farmhouse before burning it down. And they actually documented themselves burning farmhouses, blowing up farmhouses, destroying people's wagons, literally dynamiting farms, poisoning wells, destroying churches, and putting women and children to concentration camps. This is such a violation of all the rules of war, and they had just signed in 1898, the year before this war, the Hague Rules of Warfare, which principles everyone should have known anyway, but long before that, you don't target civilians in a war. 30,000 farms were destroyed. Millions of cattle and sheep were slaughtered. Vast amounts of crops were destroyed. Wells were poisoned. People put into concentration camps, and people died of starvation as part of the deliberate policy. This was the policy that if you had a male relative out in the field fighting, you got quarter rations, quarter what you needed to survive. And people died of starvation. People died of typhus. People died because they wouldn't even give them soap. They said soap's a luxury. And people died in horrific conditions. And it was up to Emily Hobhouse to record and to report these methods of barbarism which raised the horror of the world. Interesting that 120 years ago, the Boers were the most respected people in the world, the Brits were the most despised people on the planet, and just a mere 60 years later, the Boers were the most hated people on the planet. Interesting how things change. But you go to the Anglo-Boer War Museum in Bloemfontein, and you see a memorial wall to the over 5,800 Boer men who died either killed in action or who died of wounds or of diseases, and they're on the wall in different names. But facing this wall of those killed in action and who died of diseases, there is another wall. It's the Boer War Women's Monument. Over 30,000 women and children died in the British concentration camps. In what war do 6 to 7 times more women and children die than the men? And this is the horrific beginning of the 20th century, showing how warfare, the bankers' wars as they called them, the banksters' wars, were moving from soldiers fighting soldiers to where civilians are the targets of the war. They could not beat the Boer commanders in the field, so they directed the energies on the women and children back at home, which is the most reprehensible. And so they've got a wall with over 32,000 names of Boer women and children who died in those camps, and I was surprised to find even 3 Hammonds on the wall. For freedom, folk, and fatherland. Enemy combatants who surrender or are captured are not to be mistreated in any way. And yet, in the Second World War, the Russians, having invaded Poland, took all the officers and NCOs and shot them all in the back of the head. The Katyn Forest Massacre, which was denied for something like 70 years. They lied, they attributed it to the enemies, said the Germans did it, whereas the Poles always knew that it was done by the Russians, by the communists, the Soviets, by the very express order of Joseph Stalin. And it took Boris Yeltsin and to admit and to bring out the files, and finally the main files were handed over in recent years by Vladimir Putin, admitting, yes, the Soviets killed the entire Polish intelligentsia, the entire leadership, their professors, their ministers, officers, NCOs, represent the leadership of Poland. The worst crime you can imagine, destroying the entire leadership of a country. And now it's out. That is the worst example of targeting prisoners of war. But worse than that, 1 million Ukrainians and 2 million Russians, most of them civilians, Western Europe, were betrayed into the hands of the communists at the end of the Second World War as a result of the Yalta Agreement. And more German soldiers died after the war in American and Russian prison camps than were killed in action during the war, during the 6 years of war on all the fronts. And so the hideous mistreatment of prisoners of war by the Allies, as I said, crimes and mercies. The Black Book of Communism documents a lot of these horrors, that the communist regimes were the worst and most egregious culprits in targeting civilians and prisoners of war. And Professor R.J. Rummel, political science professor, has documented death by government. But military necessity should be governed by the principle of minimum force. In fact, the classic minimum force is where you take a champion from one side and the other, like the classic is David versus Goliath, and we'll accept the results of the war. So instead of whole armies fighting, potentially hundreds or thousands of people dying, we're going to have a champion from each side. I think in lieu of this, what they should do in this present war is, why don't we have a contest where you put President Biden and Vladimir Putin in the ring and let them determine it amongst themselves, and we'll settle for that result. Something like that would just be fair. I mean, this was done through many years, that you'd have kings fight it out or champions of different sides. Minimum force, that's the ideal. So every means must be taken to limit excessive and unnecessary death and destruction. Anyone identify who this monument is remembering? Joan of Arc. Nor may combatants use weapons or methods of warfare which are evil. And so the principle of you're not damaging the fruit trees, you're not targeting civilians, obviously you must use weapons that are not targeting unnecessarily and causing huge loss of life. You've got to be more precise. For example, in the Second World War, they would send up 1,000 bombers, flatten a town, because they meant to get the bridge. The bridge is still standing, but the entire town on both sides of the river is flattened, vast amounts of people killed. I mean, that's the kind of waste of life, destruction of property, whereas a precision-guided weapon can now take out the bridge without harming anything on the other side. So, you know, obviously precision weapons are more ideal to Christian conscience than the saturation bombing, vast amounts of targeting civilians, which was common in the Second World War. A just war must be concluded with a just peace. There's no point in fighting if the result afterwards isn't better than it was before. Revenge is not to be permitted. Life and property must be respected and the rule of law must be upheld. That's the whole point of warfare. Knights in the Middle Ages had to spend the whole night before they were knighted in prayer and fasting before the altar in the local church or cathedral, and they were sworn to defend the defenseless, to uphold justice and mercy, and to protect. And so these, you weren't entrusted with weapons and the skills of arms without having a Christian duty to use it in a godly way. This was not the case during the First World War with the Ottoman Empire, where they targeted the Armenian Christians. And there's a memorial to the 1.5 million Armenian Christians murdered in 1915 in the Holocaust, the genocide organized by the Ottoman Turks. The Armenians never forget, but I'm afraid most people in the world have never even heard of it. And then, can anyone identify what this memorial is for, or where this memorial is? Should be in the news right now, but it isn't. It's in Ukraine. It's a memorial to the victims of Stalin's Holodomor, the hunger plague, death by hunger, where 11 million Ukrainians were starved to death deliberately by Joseph Stalin's hideous dekulakization, his land reform. Now, by these biblical standards, there have been many senseless and unnecessary wars in which neither side was at all concerned with righteousness, and where both sides share the guilt. And I think the classic of it is this one, the Charge of the Light Brigade. Incredibly brave action in an absolutely worthless war. For what possible purpose was Britain and France in the Crimea anyway? What were they doing there? They were fighting for the Ottoman Turkish persecutors of the church against the Russians, who were seeking to force the Turks to treat the Christians well and not to massacre their Christian populations, the Ottoman Empire. So we were on the wrong side. I mean, brave as the Light Brigade were, noble 600, but they were making a fruitless charge in a war where we were on the wrong side. Yeah, it doesn't matter how fast you push the pedal down on the accelerator. If you're going in the wrong direction, it's not going to get you to your destination any faster. You know, the faster you go, but if you're on the wrong road and you're going in the wrong direction, what good is that? And I'm afraid there's many a war that shouldn't have been fought. 1914, the First World War broke out. 2014, I was invited to England to speak at memorials for the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the First World War. And I saw the beginning of this living memorial. Tower of London. Poppies. Hundreds of poppies. Thousands of poppies. 880,000 poppies. One poppy representing a British or Commonwealth soldier, British or Empire soldier, who died in the First World War, which included South Africans, Rhodesians, New Zealanders, Canadians, Australians. And every night they would read out the names of more. They called us blood-swept lands and seas of red. And of course some were in the air, because there were quite a number killed in the first air wars as well. And they would be reading out the names every night. People would gather to hear, and this took 5 months. They started on the 4th of August, when Britain declared war, and ended on the 11th of November symbolically for the armistice. So there were 5 months of these being planted, volunteers were planting them, and names being read out. And it's very moving, but I don't know what other people think, but when I saw this, I just saw red. What did they die for? What was the First World War for? The Austrian Archduke and his wife Sophie on their 10th wedding anniversary were murdered by anarchist communist terrorists in Sarajevo, supported by the Serbian government who trained and armed them, who provide the bombs and the guns and cyanide tablets and everything else. And Serbia was a terrorist nation, a terrorist-sponsoring nation, a rogue nation that had sponsored the assassinations of vast amounts of people, including throwing bombs at the wedding procession of Queen Victoria's granddaughter who was marrying the King of Spain, including assassinating the wife, the Empress of the Archduke of in charge of the Emperor of Austria, including murdering many top leaders, royal people, ministers of the gospel. There was a spate of anarchistic murders, communist terrorist murders. And Serbia was the brunt of a lot of it, and Austria was going to deal with it. And that was between Austria and Serbia. What did it have to do with Rhodesia and South Africa? Or America, Australia? And we all got, what did it have to do with Britain? And why did Britain end up on the side of the terrorists? What on earth, who benefited from the First World War? 880,000 people, just in the British Empire alone. 2 million in Germany. The millions of people who died at the end of the First World War, the worst catastrophe in the history of Christian civilization. Christian Europe had destroyed itself. And the greatest missionary-sending nations in the world had exhausted themselves by wiping out the cream of the earth. When I went to Ypres, I went to 6 war cemeteries. And, you know, you naturally look, are there any of your family name then? I counted 65 Hammonds on the walls of 6 of the cemeteries I went to. And there's 140 British war cemeteries in a 10-mile radius around Ypres. And the ones on the walls are the ones that couldn't find their bodies because of artillery. Because if they could find their bodies, they're buried in a grave with a cross. The ones on the walls are the ones that couldn't recover the bodies. So I went to the British and Commonwealth Graves Commission, and they looked on the computers and informed me that 480 Hammonds died in the First World War for king and country, apparently. You just wonder what the world would look like if our forefathers had not wasted their time and been so gullible as to fight for worthless bankers' wars, for worthless Marxists, mass murderers and politicians, lies and deceit. And what good did the First World War ever do? Nothing for us. Did a lot of good for communism, did a lot of good for the globalists, but nothing much for us. So the 11th of November, yes, we light a candle, we switch off the lights in our home, we remember at 11 of November the people who died in the wars, my father's helmet from the North African campaign, 8th Army. We must honour those who were courageous, but that doesn't mean we should let the politicians who sent them there get away with it, without censure, without learning from it. Because here we are at the brink of another potential world war, and for what and why? Although having said that, we can also discern history many necessary wars, which were defensive and just. For example, the Battle of Tours, 1732 in France, was one such landmark battle. Charles Martel the Hammer rallied the Christian soldiers of Europe on the plains of Poitiers in the Battle of Tours and courageously stood firm, resisting 6 furious charges of the Muslim cavalry, which before that time had been unbeaten. They'd taken the whole of North Africa. They'd taken the whole of Spain. Now they were moving into France. Well, they routed them and sent them fleeing back across the Pyrenees Mountains, south of France, back into Spain. There's the Reconquista, which was a long battle, which liberated Spain from 800 years of Islamic occupation and oppression, finally culminating the fall of Granada in 1492, which is the same year that Columbus sailed the ocean blue, because Spain could now sponsor an exploration to the west now that they had defeated the Moors and chased the Muslims out of Spain. The Great Siege of Malta, what a great example of Christian courage and fortitude. Totally defensive war, protecting Malta from Islamic jihadists in 1565. The Battle of Lepanto, the last great sea battle between rowing vessels, and a phenomenal, monumental success, October 1571, when the Turkish Navy was decisively defeated. Something like 200 ships of the fleet sunk or captured. Now, these were other vital defensive battles which protected Europe from being overwhelmed by Islamic invasions. And these commemorate the hussars, the winged hussars of Poland, the cavalry who swept in to Vienna to lift the siege of Vienna in 1683, another major turning point which protected Europe from becoming Eurabia. If Vienna had fallen to the Turks in 1683, history would be very different. In Deuteronomy 20, verse 1 to 4, we read, when you go out to battle, notice, when, it's not if, when you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them. For the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. So it shall be when you're on the verge of battle that the priest shall approach and speak to the people. And he shall say to them, hear, O Israel, today you're on the verge of battle with the enemies. Do not let your heart faint. Do not be afraid. Do not tremble and or be terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to save you. Deuteronomy 20 also makes clear that you are to enlist all men from the age of 20 up and conscript them for war. Now, many of the Psalms are prayers to God for guidance in war, or hymns of thanksgiving to the Lord for victory in battle. And maybe some people who've not been in the military or been in times where their lives are in danger might feel a bit awkward about some of the prayers and feel, this feels a bit uncomfortable. But they're there for good reason. They're the prayer book and the hymn book of the Bible because, David was a man after God's own heart, and David was a soldier, and David knew what it was to trust God in battle. And so it's very good that we remember that the war psalms are of the Prince of Peace. The scriptures reveal that God is a God of war, as well as a God of peace, because he is first and foremost a God of justice. And justice sometimes needs to be enforced through war. On occasions, God has not only permitted war, but he's commanded it, such as with Joshua going into the Promised Land, both as a judgment on the incredibly wicked people who lived in the land, but also as a means of training God's people. In the Bible, military defense against invaders is given the same status as capital punishment for murderers. It's not nice to amputate a limb, but sometimes to save the whole body, you have to amputate a limb. And I don't say that just theoretically. My mother needed her leg amputated. And my mother, being a nurse, never wanted any part of her body amputated. And she threatened and warned us, never sign anything permitting amputation. I mean, she has particularly had an abhorrence for amputations. Nothing. So when my mother went into a coma, the doctor sought from me permission to amputate her limb. Now, he had told her she needed to amputate her toe, then part of the foot, then the whole foot, and just from a life of smoking, and leg was going gangrenous, circulation was bad, and her whole leg from above the knee needed to be amputated by this point because she had refused all the way along. But now she is unconscious, so it fell to me. I phoned my elder brother in Joburg and asked, he said, well, no good mom hating us both, you sign it. I was in Cape Town, and my mom was not happy. I mean, she lost her leg, but she went from being gray. She was totally gray at that stage to getting color back in life. We moved into a house because without a leg, she couldn't drive a car. She didn't have a work. She couldn't even live in a home, which was on the first floor, and there was no lift. And so my mom lost a lot of her mobility. She moved into a home. But as a result, she came to the Lord. She became a dynamic, enthusiastic follower of the Lord, got involved in our mission, was involved in the family devotions, going to church with us every Sunday. And she gained another 3.5 years of her life. Now, that amputation was traumatic. It was not done easily, but it was necessary to save her life, and it did in every way. And you've got to think of capital punishment and war in the same way. It's not nice, but sometimes you've got to cut off a gangrenous limb to save the rest of the body. If all the people with a conscience refuse to fight, then it will leave the battlefields in the hands of men without a conscience, and that is bad. I praise God, even as I'm torn about the war right now going on, knowing that Russia and Ukraine are both countries with millions of Christians, knowing that there's Christian soldiers in both the Russian army and the Ukrainian army. But I praise God for that. Because you need men with a conscience in the battlefield, because they may inject some mercy in a situation which would not be if they weren't there. When a Christian soldier's in the location, they can make a difference. So just giving an example. One of the unjust imperial wars of Britain was the Anglo-Zulu War, 1879. You might recall Battle of Essawan and so on, worst defeat the British Army ever suffered at the hands of a native army, and boy was there vengeance. There was this vengeance mentality. And so the British went in with everything to crush the Zulu. And in they went, Battle of Ulundi, horrific lances, Gatling guns. They crushed the Zulu impis at Ulundi. And they tracked down King Keshwayo and they took him into custody. Now, there was this mentality of hatred for Keshwayo. But the officer who captured him was a Christian. And he treated Keshwayo well. In fact, he ordered his unit to present arms and to give the royal salute to Keshwayo as he was marched into captivity. And he was treated well. He was brought down to Cape Town to the castle, and Commandant General of the Cape, Charles Gordon, who was also a dedicated evangelical Christian, was ordered, throw him in the dungeon. But General Charles Gordon did nothing of the sort. Because Charles Gordon loved the Lord. And he, in fact, was outspoken in saying, this is an unjust war. Britain took first blood. The Zulus hadn't attacked us. We invaded them. We're in the wrong. Which you can imagine, it didn't make him very popular in the Cape. In fact, he lost his position shortly after that. But General Gordon in no way restrained King Keshwayo. He was treated as an honored guest, had full range of the castle. He was never locked up. And his wives were given everything that they wanted to cook, exactly the meals he wanted. And in fact, Charles Gordon sat down and explained the gospel to Keshwayo, prayed with him, read the Bible to him, had some gospel tracts translated into Zulu, had people help him to present the gospel, and organized for the king to travel to England to meet Queen Victoria, who then gave him back his kingdom and sent him back with some restitution being done. It's even when the army, or even when your country and your army is doing something wrong, if you've got Christian soldiers there, they can inject some mercy and grace that would not be there otherwise. So I think it's always good to have men with a conscience in the battlefield. However, foreign military adventurism does not fulfill the requirements of a just war. And let's face it, I saw a book a while ago, All the Countries We've Invaded. And it's a book about the British Empire having invaded 200 and something countries of the world. I think there's only, is it 8 or 11 countries of the world that Britain hasn't invaded sometime in the history. And they accuse Germany of being militaristic and aggressive. You know, like, wow, talk about the pot calling the kettle black. But anyway, I mean, here's Britain condemning Putin for aggression. And you think, well, how did you get the world's largest empire and conquer 1/4 of the world's land surface and population? You know, was by going around with Girl Scouts and collecting donations. People weren't just giving their countries to Britain. So it's a bit funny that. Instead of sending the Marines, I mean, this has been an American thing. The moment there's some problem, send in the Marines. So I said, don't send in the Marines, send in the missionaries. There's no military or political solution to the complex crises that are endemic to many parts of the world, especially the Middle East. They need the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. They don't need to be bombed. Instead of sending bombs, we need to sow Bibles throughout these regions. Instead of intervening in the incessant wars, we need to bombard them with gospel radio broadcasts and ministry through the internet and Bibles online and wholeheartedly work to fulfill the Great Commission. That's more constructive. We will do more to undermine terrorism and aggression by fulfilling the Great Commission than we will by military expeditions. There are frequently alternatives to war, including diplomatic and economic measures. There's the more excellent way of Christian love and gospel ministry. David was a conqueror. David killed Goliath. But Jesus is more than a conqueror. He took Saul, the persecuted church, and turned to Paul, the apostle. Isn't that a better way? The wise Christian does not seek to selfishly avoid the problems of the world, but he courageously steps out in faith to be part of the solution. Consider the example of Switzerland and their armed neutrality. The Swiss are not pacifists. They take national defense very seriously. I was traveling to a minister's conference in Switzerland, and I saw the shooting range. And I got closer, I said, is this a pistol range? It seemed awfully, where they shoot from? He said, no, it's a rifle range. They shoot from the other side of the valley. They shoot from the other side of the valley? over, I mean, fields and cars. And I mean, there's a road traveling there, pedestrians, cyclists. They said, "Our people are good shots." Well, sure they are, but I mean, I don't know how many countries put a shooting range across thoroughfares. Well, one family I was staying with, a missionary family, and they had a mission station. And so in one of the apartments, a little apartment, I looked at a young man across the table and said, "Are you in the army?" And he smiled and said, "Of course, we all know army." I said, "How long does it take you to get ready for war?" And he said, "I don't know." And I said, "Can I time you?" He said, "What now?" I said, "Starting now." And 5 minutes, 20 seconds later, boots laced up, ready, magazine in, gun at the ready. His family got so excited. His sister brought out another machine gun. Next thing is, brothers and sisters brought other weapons. Now you can see a whole generation, First World War, Second World War, Cold War, more current, and a sword. And there was explosives, anti-tank weapons. Now this is just one little apartment on a mission station in Switzerland. What do they have in the post-stamps? Their national sport. They love target practice. I mean, Switzerland doesn't just make great chocolates, great cheese, and great clocks. They make great rifles. And every Sunday, Saturday, the hills are alive with the sound of gunfire. Going to the shooting range is so normal. Do you know, if you're male in Switzerland, you must serve in the army. If you're female, you don't have to serve in the army. But if you want to do shooting practice, the government will give you a gun free and give you a crate of ammunition a year. Free. Now, how's that? Wow. No wonder they are a free country. Shooting is part of the subjects at school. I mean, wouldn't you like to go to a school like that? And that's why if you're up against the Swiss in international shooting competitions, they tend to win. And don't be surprised to see people walking and cycling with rifles and machine guns in Switzerland because, hey, like, what's strange about that? And when you look around, you see Switzerland does not have an army. Switzerland is an army. I mean, this could be the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker, and the chocolate manufacturer out there. They all have their normal jobs, but they're just regularly training, practicing, hiking. And they don't just look good, they can fight. I mean, the Swiss are a very capable military. And their logic is, if you want peace, prepare for war. Now, isn't that a good principle? And so the Swiss can say, you have your point of view, and I have mine. They won't attack you, but they will defend. In fact, in the Second World War, do you know, the Swiss shot down German, American, British, French, Italian aircraft that violated the airspace. They interned thousands of foreign airmen in their areas. They treat them well, but they're effectively prisoners during the war. They would not release them until the war was over to any belligerent who came into their place, whether they fled or whatever, they held them. And Switzerland took their neutrality seriously, but they had total mobilization. They stayed out of the war because they aggressively defended borders. And when there was violations, testing by the French, Italians, Germans, Americans, British, they had artillery exchanges, they fought, they made sure that they preserved integrity. They weren't passive. They were armed neutrals. However, the primary Swiss involvement in foreign conflicts is sending in humanitarian relief, such as through the Red Cross. And the Red Cross is the world's greatest humanitarian movement, all founded by Henri Dunant, an evangelistic man, an evangelical man. In fact, when I went to the International Committee for the Red Cross Museum in Geneva, first thing I saw was Henri Dunant's Bible and a whole lot of scripture verses. Parable of the Good Samaritan, go and do likewise, heal the sick, preach the gospel, love your neighbor, love your enemy. And that's now most of the people in the field of the Red Cross are secular people. But its founder was thoroughly evangelical, and that's why they have the Red Cross as a symbol. Now, isn't that a better way of getting involved in foreign wars? America's first president, George Washington, in his farewell address, cautioned Americans against entangling alliances. He warned Americans never to get involved in Europe's wars. Imagine if America had just stuck with that. Imagine if America was like one big armed neutral Switzerland, whose only involvement in foreign wars is to go in and help in humanitarian help, send missionaries. Imagine. American President Theodore Roosevelt actually intervened in the Russian-Japanese War of 1905, but not as a belligerent. He didn't take sides. He stepped in and negotiated a peaceful end to the tragic conflict. Isn't that a better way? Imagine if America was a peacemaker instead of a war maker bombing other countries. I think this is the better way. It's much better. During the height of the Cold War, we were involved in a just war in Rhodesia and in Southwest Africa. We were defending these peaceful nations from communist terrorist attacks. We're holding the line against Soviet expansionism. Yet during our Bible study and prayer meeting in the South African Army, the Lord gave me the vision of responding to communist hate with Christian love. They're coming to us with hate. Have we ever gone to them with love? They're sending terrorists to us. Have we ever sent missionaries to them? We need to send missionaries to them. Has South Africa ever sent missionaries to Cuba or to Russia? 1980, I didn't think so. But we have since. They're smuggling in landmines and limpet mines and grenades to sow terror in our communities. We need to smuggle Bibles and Christian books into their territories. We need to go and win converts amongst them. We need to make disciples and undermine the communist tyranny with the fulfillment of the Great Commission. And we've been successful. We have seen the communist nations we targeted, Mozambique, Angola, Zambia, even up to Ethiopia, toppled. The Lenin idols as well. And South Sudan, free from Islamic Sudan. This year, next month, will mark 40 years of frontline fellowship crossing borders into war zones and restricted access areas. And to mark this, I've been working on completing the book Frontline Behind Enemy Lines for Christ, recounting many of the untold stories of these initiatives that God used for the extension of his kingdom. And by God's grace, we hope that this book will be available by next month, by April, as we first cross the border then. Ecclesiastes 3 verse 1 to 11 has this lovely poem. To everything there is a season. There's a time for every purpose under heaven. A time to plant and a time to pluck what was planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away and a time to gather. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to gain and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time of war and a time of peace. He has made everything beautiful in its time and he's put eternity in the hearts of men. Ecclesiastes 3 shows there is a time for war. But not as often as we would often like. There are times when sinful men need to be restrained by laws and force. Yes. Think of Gideon. That's 300. Liberty needs to be defended. Freedom often comes through and often needs to be maintained by hard fighting. Like a muddied spring or a polluted well is a righteous man who gives way to the wicked. We do not want to be those who give way to the wicked. If all the Christians became a pacifist, would that mean that all atheists and Muslims and communists would become pacifists? Not likely. It is useless for the sheep to pass resolutions in favor of vegetarianism while a wolf remains of a different opinion. For those pacifists hoping for worldwide peace, listen to the words of our Lord Jesus. I do not think that I came to bring peace to the world. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. And the teachings of Christ do sometimes bring division. Now, we don't want to start wars, but sometimes divisions come in families even, between those who love Christ and those who don't, those who surrender to the gospel and those who don't. And sometimes there's a sword that comes. But God has brought peace even to the violent Vikings. He brought them to the foot of the cross. So I wrote The Christian at War, which has also been translated to German and Afrikaans and Spanish, to particularly help soldiers in war. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. You have to make peace. It takes action. Sometimes military action. Most times missionary action. Missionary action is better. You have never lived until you've almost died. And for those who fight for it, life is a flavor the protected will never know. May God find us faithful to his word, and may we be prepared to defend the defenseless and to rescue the innocent. When we have to fight, may God grant that we will be fast and accurate. Make disciples, teach obedience to all things the Lord has commanded. The Bibles of the Christians are more powerful than the bombs of the Muslims and the Marxists. Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature, that they will come and every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. They either bow today in the day of grace to Jesus as Lord and Savior, or they will bow to him as King of Kings, Lord of Lords, the Conqueror, and the Eternal Judge on the day of judgment. But every knee will bow. So, we will be uploading this on our frontlinemissionessay.org website. Should give you advance notice. We've got the Great Commission course coming up, planned for 24th of June to 13th of July. You'll find quite a few testimonies, chapters, character studies, and victorious Christians who changed the world on soldiers, like Oliver Cromwell, Gustavus Adolphus. Great, tremendous soldiers that God has used. And of course, there's lots to learn from our history. By God's grace, this book should be available in less than a month, hopefully in 3 weeks' time, God willing. And I should also say, in less than 2 weeks, Wednesday the 23rd of March, we are planning a home education workshop here in the morning from 9 till 2, and it's open for both children and parents. Genesis, the Ark, and the Flood. We'll be having presentations aimed at the high schoolers and parents, teachers, here and outside in the meeting area. We'll be having a primary school children's program as well. So there'll be a dual program on Genesis, the Ark, and the Flood. So that's upcoming. Any questions at all on when is it right to fight?
Now, I agree 100%, but what I have found, and I've seen it work a couple of times in an extreme situation, where a friend of mine was, she's got a soup kitchen and she was held. When the guy's holding a gun against him, you start, you don't ask for me, you say, Jesus, Lord, please just forgive this man. So she started praying, it's happened 3 times in an hour, not just in one person. So, in that situation only, I do agree 100%, but in a case like that, somewhere that guy was probably brought to by a Christian grandmother or something, and you touch on you touch him somehow or other where he doesn't know what to do, this person's not doing so. So that would be one of the few occasions where you can try that, to not fight it, but that is a one-on-one situation. I mean,
that,
in a case like
that might be a better way of responding more often than not.
Yes, it's hard to keep your head when somebody's doing that to you. That is the most important. I've got a lot of respect for that. But that would be one of the few occasions. But otherwise, you know, that's...
Well, when I'm saying when is it right to fight, I'm certainly not saying it's often or always. It's seldom. Most of the time we should use more peaceful resolutions. We've been times when we could have used violence and we chose to talk our way out of it, pray our way out of it, negotiate. It's always better. You don't ever want to go to war on a personal level all the way through to national level without it being the last resort. We try more creative, peaceful resolution methods mostly. And that can work. And that has worked.
That's in that situation.
Yes. Alpha.
This sort of reminded me of David Livingstone. You said, you quoted from him when you said, he loves peace so much that he's ready to fight for it.
That's a good quote. Yes. So, when I showed the picture of Livingstone releasing slaves, in fact, especially in Malawi, he released a lot of slaves, and Zambia, and Mozambique, and Tanzania. He freed slaves. Because he is there, and he actually used his double-barreled rifle and six-barreled revolver sometimes to persuade some Islamic slave traders to let the captives go. And so it's a valid thing to do. There are times when you can do that. And he, on occasion, made a bonfire of the yokes that they would yoke people's necks together with and lead them off to slavery. And he made a bonfire and burned them all and things like this. And there was even occasion when Livingston had to open fire, and his men of his party opened fire on Muslim slave traders who had encircled them and were making aggressive moves to wipe them out. And when he was criticized back at home, he said, I love peace more than any man, but I go beyond you at this. I'm willing to fight for peace. That's a good quote. Thank you, Alpha, for reminding me of that. Anything else? Any other comments, questions?
What are some of the most common excuses for starting a war?
Well, I mean, honestly, you just need to listen to the Bidens and so on these days. What a lot of nonsense.
Weapons of mass destruction, hidden in
These weapons of mass destruction are wrong. They kill hundreds of thousands of people, but they can't find the weapons of mass destruction. They destroy Iraq, one of the finest economies in the Middle East, where Christians had more freedom of religion and freedom of movement than anywhere else in the Middle East, with the exception of Syria. I mean, Syria and Iraq is where Christians are treated the best, had the most freedom, and had the strongest Christian communities in the whole of the Middle East. And America's got to go and bomb these places and destroy them. For what? They've got weapons of mass destruction. There's no indication that they ever did, despite 20 years of searching, nor is there any indication that they were a threat to anyone. They were ready to defend themselves. They had fought Iran, but to be fair, when they'd fought Iran, the American government had put them up to it and were supporting them to fight Iran. So, you know, even that long, hideous war between Iran and Iraq was done with American incitement. And at that stage, Saddam Hussein was actually American government's friend and ally, and they were aiding him. So, you know, the insanity of the whole thing. Oh, they've got weapons of mass destruction. They're committing genocide. I mean, that's what they said of the Serbians. So, for example, do you remember 1999? If I can think back to that. Time magazine, Newsweek, US News and World Report all had the same picture on the cover. They had a picture of some emaciated man. I must find this picture. Emaciated man on the cover, only a trouser, no shirt, so you could see his all of his ribs. You could see he's really very emaciated. And behind barbed wire is a bunch of other people who look fairly normal around him. But it was just zoomed in on this one person. Well, you know, not again, genocide. And this was prelude to 17,000 bombing raids in Serbia, where NATO attacked Serbia, bombed them. Why? Because they claimed they were committing genocide against the Muslim Bosnians. Now, Muslim Bosnians were allied to Al-Qaeda, Muslim terrorists who were a threat to everyone. In fact, they've committed who knows how many terrorist attacks. But to help Al-Qaeda-affiliated Bosnians, they waged war against Orthodox Christian Serbs and bombed Serbia. In fact, one of our missionaries was there when US Air Force came in and bombed. They were in a church service, and they're in a prayer meeting, and suddenly her own Air Force bombed her, American citizen, Martha McComb, and she is showered in glass in a prayer meeting in a church by her own Air Force bombing her. I mean, while she's a missionary in Serbia. And so we got a very different perspective. But there they claimed that they were doing genocide. It turned out that this man was not being starved. He had a medical condition, which is why he's so emaciated. And they weren't in a concentration camp. They built a fence a few meters wide with barbed wire. It was just, you know, you could walk around it on any side. And the photographers were on one side and asked these Bosnians to all herd on that side. And they had this man come from, had him take off his shirt, and it's a totally staged picture. And everyone knew that this was not a concentration camp. These people were completely free. There was no restraint. Nobody was being starved deliberately, anything like this. And they made that image went around the world. And they were all campaigning, and as a result, America went in 17,000 bombing raids. I mean, not just America, Britain, France, NATO, the whole lot. And they bombed the Serbs, and for what? A totally fraudulent reason. There was no good reason for it at all. And it came out later, it's just a totally staged picture. Just as staged as I remember back in 1980s, there was a picture of a car burning in a street in Soweto with some young student standing with a fist. And from different angles, Newsweek, Time magazine, all the same normal suspects. It turned out that this was a wrecked car that was in someone's yard, and they paid him to drag it out in the street, and people set the lights so they could get a photo of. This is a completely staged picture. And this was just on the front of. I spoke to journalists, happened to be in a plane at this time traveling between Europe and South Africa. I happened to sit next to a journalist, and I mentioned this picture, and he laughed about it and so on. And when I pushed him, but he said, hey, don't start judging. I says, we've got deadlines. Our time is valuable. Life in South Africa is cheap. You know, so what if we paid these guys to do this? And he admits it. He said, we sometimes throw sweets or food or money into a dustbin so we can get pictures of the kids climbing into the dustbin and say, this is South Africa. You know, people are starving and so on. And he admitted that they staged it. There was another one where, even worse than that, we know a black mayor who was necklaced. And his wife said they were surprised when the media all arrived and they were sitting up in a semicircle around the house. I've actually got the video. I think Rob just delivered it. We've got that video here. We must digitize. But they set up and they're wondering, what's this for? And next thing, the mob arrives, and the media's all set up. And they go in, and they drag this mayor out, and they necklace him. Tire, petrol, murdered him. And nobody got in the way. They all did it carefully to make sure it's semicircle, so as not to in any way infringe. So media, all the big media houses of America were there in order to film this, BBC as well. And it was obviously organized. So they knew a crime was going to take place. They didn't tell the police. They just turned up and they filmed this cold-blooded murder. And those video images went around the world. And it was an important part of mobilizing fear. You know, you mustn't cross the ANC, you must do what they want, or else you're going to get necklaced. So many times they, you know, false flags, rigged events, fraud, lies. There are those people like Stephen Mitford Goodson, who wrote History of Central Banking and Enslavement of Mankind, who said that all the wars of the 20th century have been bankers' wars, starting with the Anglo-Boer War, being Rothschild's wanted control of the gold in Transvaal, and that they financed the war and things like this. The bankers' wars. I said the 20th century has been the century of bankers' wars. But of course, you can't tell people, hey, we've got to go to war because Rothschild wants it. They've got to give you another reason. So it's normally, let's think, what are they? We've got to go to war because they're Nazi, white supremacist, racist, for democracy, for freedom.
Freedom,
yeah, definitely freedom. They've got weapons of mass destruction.
Genocide.
They're genocide. There's gas. For example, it's been proven now, each of the gas attacks that the Syrian government have done has been done by the allies. Turkey's organized it. Saudi Arabia's organized it. It's all been done. Americans have provided the gas in many cases, and they've delivered it there. And it's always at the most convenient times. When Obama wanted a reason to bomb Syria, suddenly, he's using gas in his people. Now, you know, people who are using phosphorus bombs and napalm are getting morally indignant because somebody's using gas. Phosphorus is much worse. But anyway, quite aside from that, there's no evidence the Syrian army ever used gas. I mean, it's the dumbest thing they could do. They were winning the war anyway. Why would they do the one thing you're not allowed to do in warfare? I mean, you can incinerate people with napalm. You can incinerate people with phosphorus, but you're not allowed to gas people. That's just like, you know, gee, they've got some standards here. So, in that situation, whenever they needed to mobilize a new bombing of Syria and the Syrian army was winning, they would accuse the Syrian army of having used gas. And it was proved time and again that all of these were false flags. It was done by the other side in order to blame them. So they are not beyond rigging up their own atrocities. Any other excuse you can think of for wars?
Natural resources or...
Oh, well, they'll never admit that we're going to war because they've got a lot of petrol there. No, they won't admit that. But let's face it, there's a lot of people around the world who've suffered for many different reasons, and they don't care. Like, it doesn't matter how many Christians get killed in Myanmar, in Burma. That doesn't matter, you know.
When against the virus, our governments have been killing us with injections to kill this virus for the last 2 years.
Yes, we've got to destroy your life because we care about your health.
So that's another excuse for they call it a war. We're going to fight this virus as if it's some sort of sentient being.
Yes. Oh, so just take, for example, a classic reason used for why Obama had to send cruise missiles into Syria. Assad is killing his people with gas. Therefore, we've got to send cruise missiles and kill more of his people in a far more humane way with American technology. No. You're not allowed to kill your own people. We'll kill them for you. I mean, what makes sense? If they're doing something, you know, how about sending some medical help or whatever? But why would you send missiles into a country to punish them for you say that they're killing their people? So why kill more of their people? The logic is shot. It's about as bad as it comes.
Peter, you've got a military background as well, and so have I, but we've got a lot of young people here. Did we ever discuss when we were young, hey, let's go to war, let's go kill people? Young men do not want to do that. They get fooled, you know, I mean, they get lied to go to war.
Yeah, well, look, we were conscripted, but I must say I was enthusiastic to go into the army, but we wanted to do a bit to fight communism, to defend our families. Yeah. But there was no such thing. But if they were saying, you know, we want you to go to some other country far away, well, what's that got to do? We were the South African Defence Force. If we're not defending South Africa, which at that stage includes Southwest Africa, there was no point. So, you know, if they suddenly wanted you to go off to Iraq or something, it'd be, why? That's why I don't understand how our forefathers got conned into going out and fighting in Delville Wood and, you know, France and all over the place, or the poor Aussies going to Gallipoli to be used to do what? I mean, what a worthless, horrible, terrible thing. They took the cream of Australia and New Zealand and they had them charging the machine guns of the Turks. They had no chance. They couldn't even reach the lines. All they could do is go over the top and see how far they could run before they got the machine gun. It was just, and the British kept sending them in. And it was, this was one of Winston Churchill's just insane ideas. It was the most unwinnable war of all. I mean, how on earth could they possibly take those heights? It was insane from the beginning. I mean, Gallipoli, they still have Gallipoli Day. They're called Anzac Day. Australians. By the way, a while ago, I was up in Fromes in France, where they had discovered an Australian battle site. Some poor farmers going along came across a vast amount of bones and so on. And they did investigation, found, oh, this entire Australian division or something, massive amount of Australians died there. So they set aside a new war memorial cemetery and so on. And it was the first battle Australians had ever fought in Europe. 1915, I think, they came in the Western Front, they put them in, and they sacrificed them for a diversion. And it wasn't even effective diversion. It wasn't for real objective, just to distract the enemy so that the British could do something down the line. When they had this consecration of this war cemetery and so on, the Australian government invited representatives of the German army, all over, but they didn't invite any Brit. There was no British representatives there. They had everybody, the French, the Germans, but New Zealanders, they were there, Canadians, but not the British. There was no British representative allowed then. There was the sense of they used us as cannon fodder. And I don't know if you know, but in the Second World War, out of every 6 frontline combat soldiers, 5 were colonials, meaning Canadian, Australian, New Zealand, South Africa, Rhodesia, and so on. So the English or the British actually only... they were 1 out of 6 in frontline troops. So the British took most of the, you know, you've always got to have a lot of rare echelon troops to support someone in front. Everything from quartermaster stores, signals, catering, or transport. There's a vast amount of very important things that are essential to any army. But they basically reserved the combats for, you know, the colonials. It could be that they thought, well, you know, Australians and South Africans are better at this sort of thing, or whatever. Or maybe they thought they weren't as valuable. But whatever the reason was, isn't that extraordinary that they used us? I mean, I'm talking about people like my dad, as combat troops, but they kept for themselves the safer rear echelon jobs, generally speaking. And I don't know if you've been to, if you've been to any of the war cemeteries in France, and I've been to a lot of these war cemeteries in France and Belgium, where most of the British Army's buried. And it's extraordinary because how many of you have seen Saving Private Ryan film? Okay, quite a few of us. The beginning of Saving Private Ryan, it starts before going over this massive burial ground of thousands of American troops. And it starts off with, it focuses for quite a while on one so-called Star of David, the hexagon. And then goes through the thousands of crosses. Well, I don't know where he found it. I have never seen a Star of David cross anywhere in any of these war cemeteries. Not the British American. How Spielberg found the one in the whole of France to focus on at the beginning of this, I don't know. But I've never noticed them. I've been looking because you go to the war cemetery, crosses, 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 more crosses. Unbelievable amount of crosses. I see no question marks. So apparently there were no atheists or agnostics there. There's just crosses, and there's certainly no other, there's no hexagons. At least none that I've seen. The only Hickson I've ever seen a war cemetery is on Saving Private Ryan. For all I know, he might have put it there. But maybe it is. I mean, maybe some American Jewish person ended up in the American Army on a frontline position and died. But I get the impression most of them were either serving in Hollywood or in the propaganda department. Whatever they were doing, they were not in the trenches with people like my dad who were on the front like an El Alamein. So it's interesting that the bankers' boys, they don't tend to end up fighting in the bankers' wars. Any other questions, comments, observations?
Dr. Peter, I just wanted to ask, like, I haven't really thought about this, but you know what you're saying about the neutrality of the Swiss.
Mm.
Now, when I think about South Africa, and I mean, if, you know, one would hope it would never happen, but if South Africa was dragged into a war or got involved in a war, like, I'm very concerned about, you know, the direction, the political direction of the country, and I would, it just feels very difficult to justify sort of standing up for a country who's very, you know, got very questionable sort of direction, orientation. I don't really know, how does one sort of think about
it? Yes, well, at this particular moment, the only way I can imagine myself wanting to get pulled out from reserve into active duty would be if the Western Cape, or when the Western Cape declares independence, and if we need to defend the Western Cape, that I think would be a cause worth fighting for. But if the SADF wants to do, and SANDF wants to do something, it's more likely that they want to go up to the Congo or Central African Republic to defend some blood diamonds mine where some cabinet minister's cousins got some, you know, do you remember some while ago that we had some of our paratroopers killed in Central African Republic and people in Parliament saying, what's the paratroopers doing in Central African Republic? Nobody had authorised, the parliamentarians didn't even know we had troops in Central African Republic, CAR, why? There was no reason ever given. What were they doing up there? Can only be for corruption. Now, if they want to get mercenaries, they're fine, recruit mercenaries, but don't send people who are meant to be the National Defence Force of this country over for some nefarious end overseas. And that's what goes on. But I'm afraid if I was in America and any of my sons end up in the American Army in this particular situation, or Britain, you couldn't be sure they'd be defending the country. They're more likely to be off doing some who knows what, who knows where for the UN than anything to defend the country, which is why for example, in Rhodesia, even going back to the 70s, one person we knew, in fact, he helped train my brother, John Allen Coe. We've got his book downstairs. John Allen Coe was an American Marine whose protest to the Vietnam War was to desert from America and go and join the Rhodesian Army. Instead of doing 1 year in Vietnam, he did 2 years in Rhodesia and was killed in action in Rhodesia. John Allen Coe, we've got his book, The Fighting Doc, because he's as a Christian, he chose to be a medic, but I mean, he's a combat medic, and he was in the front, and he got taken out saving people's lives. John Allen Coe, I've met his mother, father, brother, lovely people. And John Allen Coe is just an example of an American who got sick of no-win wars. That was really back in Vietnam. Like, what are we doing in Vietnam? He said, I wanted to go and fight for a country that was really fighting communism with the aim to win, which was Rhodesia. Because he knew that what they were doing in Vietnam was not just. They were targeting civilians, napalm, Agent Orange, deforestation. I mean, honestly, what on earth were they doing in Vietnam? Nothing good. And at the end, they betrayed them, just like they did in Afghanistan. So I would be very demotivated to want to be involved in the U.S. Army at this present time. And having said that, while the U.S. presidents have been doing a terrible job, there's only one president that America's had since Herbert Hoover that didn't start a new war, and that's Donald Trump. I mean, one thing you can give to Donald Trump is he didn't start any new wars in his 4 years. And isn't it interesting that there was no end of problems and wars under Bush and Obama and now under Biden? But during Donald Trump, the world scene was very quiet and calm. There was next to no real major military drama. It just shows there's nothing they despise more than weakness. There's nothing they respect more than strength. It's a country that is neutral and strong, armed, prepared, minds own business, things at peace. Then you've got these meddling troublemakers. And I'm afraid the Biden family is as corrupt as anything. And they're part of this whole corruption. Ukraine's one of the most corrupt countries in the world. And now it's come out. It's no longer a conspiracy theory or anything. It's a fact. They've got biological warfare laboratories in Ukraine. What are they doing there? It's illegal, you know. It's completely against everything. Hague, rules of warfare, Geneva Convention. Biological, chemical warfare weapons are illegal. Nobody's meant to be dealing with this. They've got all kinds of special non-proliferation treaties. So a whole lot of things that are not legal in America, they're outsourced to other countries, like Ukraine, because Ukraine is so corrupt and they own the president and they can get the Attorney General fined from just a word. They can personally benefit. So, yeah.
I was raised, America is good and the Soviet is bad.
Yeah.
And now my mind is again upside down because America is not good.
I know how you feel. I was also raised to think that America was the leader of the free world and Russia was the evil empire, which it was at that time.
But
boy, have things changed in the last 30 years. Yep.
A comment that from myself, and I personally have never really thought about war as much as recently with this globalist agenda. And my target would only be those very top heads of state of this globalist agenda. Why must we go and kill anybody else at all? There's no justification except to those
yes.
people. Those are the only people that deserve anything
right.
coming. Russians yeah. fighting Ukrainians, me joining either side, no thank you. Muslims, no thank you. Anywhere else on this planet but them. And I think that this is a very important thing that people are just kind of we're going to make the same mistakes again
yes.
that we've made for 200 years,
yeah.
whatever you want to call it, since World War I, World War. Now I see the Turkish thing as well. It seems that we've been deceived non-stop. And when does it stop?
Yes. Well, bear in mind, as we were speaking about the Great Reset before, bear in mind the Great Reset needs a great collapse first. And so these sort of wars are super valuable for globalists to bring about their Darwinian evolution social theory. Blow everything up, and out of the ashes will rise paradise, utopia.
Is it even Darwinian? Because they don't even want the fittest to survive. The way that structured things is that the worst and the most
yes.
deranged people will survive, and the actually good people will be...
It's more Sabbatane. It's a Sabbatanism. Sabbatai Zevi and 1666. It's Luciferian. It's quite occultic. But still, look at what the goal is right now. How avoidable a war was this? Russia applied to join NATO 1992, 2002, 2004, 2006, 2008. Imagine if NATO had taken Russia in. Russia as part of the alliance, how strong would that be to counter Red China, which is a real enemy? But instead they treated Russia as an enemy and kept expanding NATO eastwards against the warnings and promises. Secretary Baker, on behalf of President George H. Bush, already in 1991 promised, when the Warsaw Pact broke up and the Soviet Union dismantled into 15 republics, NATO will not take another foot eastwards. And, well, okay. But now, even aside from that, Americans organized this coup in 2014, and it's as corrupt as anything, and they're shelling Russian Ukrainians, killing thousands of them in Luhansk and Donetsk, because they Russian majority, 95% Russian speaking in eastern Ukraine. The first thing the American state governments did was abolish minority language rights for Russians and so on, which is insane. Denied their request for autonomy. If they'd done that, you wouldn't have had the secession and so on. And when they keep shelling them, well, at a certain point, they're going to turn to Mother Russia for protection, obviously. As recently as January, Vladimir Putin requested President Biden to give an assurance that America will not put missiles in Ukraine. Refused to give such a guarantee. February, Vladimir Putin requested President Biden to meet with him that they could discuss the crisis and alleviate it. Biden refused to meet with him. I mean, these are just simple things. If they had given a guarantee. NATO will stay out of Ukraine. Ukraine will not join NATO. Ukraine will be neutral. This could have stopped the war. We won't put missiles and anything on. Stop shelling Russians in eastern Ukraine and the Donbass region of Luhansk and Donetsk. Any of that might have prevented the war. But no, it's like the American government of Biden is hell-bent, literally hell-bent, on starting this war. And once the war starts, they Vlad the bad, Vlad the mad. Putin's crazy, no reason, for no reason, unprovoked aggression and so on and so forth. But I mean, they've goaded, pushed. There's two sides to any story. By the way, if you really want to amuse yourself, you just need to find Russia Today. It's normally through the back stops, but I found, for example, on the Islamic Propagation Center International, ICPI, they had some Russia Today things, and I found some through India Today. And, for example, one Russia Today program I saw through the, you've got to go through the back. You can't go direct. Russia Today's blocked in the West. But I saw, for example, early hours this morning, huge, massive base, like thousands of military tents abandoned, Ukrainians, leaving huge amounts of tanks in good order, trucks, armored cars, like an entire division just abandoned. When I heard the Russians were coming, they all just fled. Ukraine's just abandoned, stripped off their weapons, helmets, rifles, on, just left the tanks and so on. And you won't get that on CNN. And then the other one is seeing people welcoming the Russians as saviors as they come in with medicine and so on. Must have been eastern Ukraine where the majority of people are Russian, but still, not something you're going to see on CNN or BBC. So it's kind of fun. If you want to get a more objective perspective, you go to WION, W-I-O-N, or India Today. The Indians are surprisingly objective. They'll give both sides, and they give good coverage, and they've got people on the ground. But they're not buying the Western narrative. They give both sides, and I thought that's actually quite positive.